Les colloques du Collège de France.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Merci beaucoup pour l'aimable invitation à cette conférence. It is my pleasure and honor, of course, to speak to you on this interesting colloquium, which really, Samantha, I think, to my knowledge, is one of the first that addresses these problems of the interrelationship of various basic concepts that we have in international space law. And therefore, I have entitled my paper, Sovereignty, Territorial Jurisdiction and Property, an Inextricable Triangle in Space Law. And I would like to briefly give an overview on what I want to show in my paper, and then, of course, try to shorten a little bit, because otherwise that would be unbearable for you to listen to everything that I have written down. This can be, hopefully, after the conference, be read somewhere if this is going to be published. In my paper, the attempt is made to describe the classical legal characteristics of space law. This will be done, on the one hand, in comparison with the other legal commons, Antarctica, the high seas, and the deep seabed, and, on the other hand, with regard to future usages. Although so far the non-existence of sovereignty, the construct of territorial jurisdiction, and the concept of property have been more or less uncontested in practice, as well as in legal literature, this may change with regard to challenges of the so-called new space era. Specifically, the concept of no gain of property on celestial bodies may be challenged in view of possible ideas of harvesting natural resources of celestial bodies. And this could also be the case even for the concept of sovereignty in case of plans or to permanently settle a celestial body, and most pointedly, with the establishment of mega-satellite constellations accompanied by jurisdiction and control of the state of registration. So in my first introductory remarks, I talk a little bit about the concept of the international commons, which was not well known in ancient international law, which basically was about the settling of the territory by states, the settling of the globe. And then, of course, we had something to do with sovereignty, and this was basically the thing. The idea with the global commons came up, of course, basically with the sea. 70% of the globe is blue, if we say so. 70% is the sea. And there we had this distinction into, only more recently, into the deep seabed and into the various zones of the sea, starting from the territorial waters towards the high seas. In the International Conference on the Law of the Sea in the 1970s, for the first time the idea that had been mentioned of the common heritage of mankind came up for the area and its resources, Article 136 of the Law of the Sea Convention, that gave this idea of patrimoine commun, of the heritage, that this was inherited and therefore belonged to all mankind and could be appropriated only under very specific conditions. International administration through an international authority that was entitled to grant licenses. This was the idea. This is very interesting for the law of the sea. Antarctica took a completely different road. When Knut Amundsen came there, it was not very, it was one of the first explorers, And later on, we had the 1959 Antarctic Treaty. And this Antarctic Treaty, kind of, in its Article 4, froze, more or less, froze any territorial titles under the Antarctic ice. They cannot be actually activated, those resources. There are some claims, but it's not more than claims. It is, you know, kind of can't be activated. So this was, so to speak, the setting of the other international commons after 1945, when this was kind of started to discuss. Now I start with the situation in outer space. Even earlier than with the respective treaty, it was clear that outer space, understood, in my opinion, as the Earth solar system, would, as well as the celestial bodies, be an international common, free from state sovereignty akin to the high seas. This was reiterated in the first resolution on outer space of 1962. And it's Articles 1 and 2 of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 that have already been mentioned. As a consequence, the American flag on the moon will never be perceived as a sign of territorial appropriation. Perhaps now under the new president this may change, but we don't know, listening to some of his statements. Different from the international commons of the deep seabed and Antarctica, the concept of territorial jurisdiction plays a central role in outer space, as well as with regard to the high seas, as noted earlier. Comparable with a vessel that sails over the high seas, space objects, for example, the spacecraft or satellite in outer space, are linked to the control station on Earth by the legal conception of jurisdiction and control in Article 8. Of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. As a consequence, the law of the state of registry is applicable within the space object, such as the spacecraft or the International Space Station. The intergovernmental agreement of the ISS features two provisions which, on the one hand, make the respective patent law of the state of registry of the respective ISS module applicable for the respective invention of the module of tremendous commercial importance. And on the other hand, the same is true for the respective criminal law, that is, the national criminal law of the registering state of the module is applicable, the law of the victim as well as the law of the tortfeasor and perpetrator. In other words, the concept of quasi-territorial jurisdiction replaces a lack of state sovereignty characteristic in space law, as is the case for any vessel on the high seas flying a flag of the state where it is registered. This is the first side of the triangle. There is a strong link between the missing of state sovereignty in outer space, including the moon and other celestial bodies, and the conception of quasi-territorial jurisdiction. Having covered these, we may just ask about property. Is there also a link between the lack of sovereignty, quasi-territorial jurisdiction, and property? In order to facilitate the research, we do not distinguish between public and private property. But indeed, the relationship of missing sovereignty, quasi-territorial jurisdiction and property expresses one of the greatest unclear areas of the entire law of outer space. It is first uncontested that any property that has been launched or otherwise carried from the Earth into outer space or on a celestial body remains untouched and unaffected as guaranteed by Article 8 of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. It remains the property of the party which held the property title prior to its placement in outer space. The naked act of transporting it to the environment of outer space does not affect its legal status. But what about objects which are already in outer space? It is beyond dispute that orbital positions or surface areas of celestial bodies cannot become property of any state or individual. This is illustrated by the case of the allotment of orbital slots and frequencies in the geostationary satellite orbit, which may only be allotted by the International Telecommunication Union and only permitted to the functional act of space objects for only a certain amount of time. In principle, the allotment of frequencies through the International Telecommunication Union for telecommunication satellites indicates that they can't be used forever and one must reapply for its use. What about natural resources of celestial bodies? Here the problem begins. Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty maintains that outer space and celestial bodies are free for use by all. Does this include the taking of rocks and minerals from celestial bodies? Opinions on this question are split. One opinion focuses on the freedom of use guaranteed by Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty, and only limited by Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty, meaning that space resource exploitation is permitted as long as it does not result in permanent appropriation of the surface of celestial bodies. The other opinion focuses on the wording of Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty and holds that the exploration and use of outer space are the province of all mankind and must be undertaken for the benefit of all humankind. According to the minutes taken during the drafting of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, this wording should ensure that any kind of monopolization of usages by one state or entity should not take place. This opinion further holds that Article 11, Paragraph 3 of the Moon Agreement of 1979 would clearly prohibit any taking of property of natural resources in place. This opinion therefore amounts to seeing space resource activities as prohibited, at least for as long as a mechanism is not established in accordance with Article 11, Paragraph 5 of the Moon Agreement, as they may not be undertaken for the sole benefit of one state or entity. In view of the rather unclear wording of Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, the limited importance of Article 11 of the Moon Agreement, limited due to its modest number of only 17 ratifications, which moreover calls for the establishment of an international legal regime, including appropriate procedures when exploitation becomes feasible, presently the tendency seems to lean toward negating the possibility of taking property of resources of celestial bodies. Currently, then, international law and practice seems to negate the possibility of the taking of property in outer space, movable or unmovable. Insofar, the triangle reads, prohibition of sovereignty, quasi-territorial jurisdiction and space objects utilized for exploration and use of outer space, but no taking of property in outer space and on celestial bodies. It should also be mentioned that any legitimation and legalization of the taking of property, that for example resources in outer space and on celestial bodies, by national space laws, is equally absolutely prohibited. Whereas countries like the United States, Luxembourg, Japan and the United Arab Emirates assert that clauses in their national space laws would allow the appropriation of pieces of celestial bodies, such possibility must strictly be denied. From the beginning of spaceflight and space law, it was clear that outer space and the celestial bodies would be an international common space and that its regulation would therefore be made through international law prepared by the United Nations. Thus, the opposite cannot be true. Rather, any attempt of regulation through national law must be an act ultra vires. The famous maxim, nemo plus juris transferre pot est quam ipsa habet, means nobody can transfer more rights than he or she, him or herself has. And national law cannot alter international law. That is it. One may ask the question whether the Artemis Accords of 2020, as a more recent interpretation, and I call it deliberately interpretation of outer space law, signed by so far 56 countries, may affect or even change the fundamentals just stated. Widely, the Accords reiterate the provisions of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967. However, whereas Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty of 67 does not explicitly mention space resources, the reference to it, as explicitly mentioned in Section 10.2 of the Artemis Accords, declares that extraction and utilization of space resources should be executed in a manner that complies with the Outer Space Treaty and in support of safe and sustainable space activities, and furthermore, does not inherently constitute national appropriation under Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty. It therefore reconfirms the provision of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967 and its relevance in modern days, while simultaneously and explicitly advocating for a reading of the treaty does permit the establishment of property on extracted space resources. Moreover, the Accords contain a duty to inform other signatories of the Accords of their space activities and their location to conduct activities in observance to the principle of due regard, and are intended to avoid harmful interference with the activities of others. As should be mentioned in this context, the obligation to maintain and protect a safety zone around the operation remains obscure. One could interpret this clause as providing for same de facto acquisition of territory on celestial bodies, which, as has been shown above, is explicitly prohibited. But we don't want to intend this of the motive of the drafters. Now I come to the challenges for the international space order through so-called new space, which are, in my opinion, considerable. Since approximately 20 years or so, we have witnessed the rise of a new age of space activities called new space. This age is characterized by a total shift of formerly governmental space activities to primarily private space activities. The American corporate entity called SpaceX is a symbol of this new trend, which does not only bring new private actors to the field, but also new activities. Besides the already mostly private activities of telecommunication satellites, enriched by remote sensing and satellite navigation, utilized in the military, but also civil sector applications, for example, navigating automobiles, ships and aircraft, the new space age saw the rise of large constellations of satellites composed of hundreds, even thousands of satellites flying in a single formation, enabling global broadband internet, of space tourism, of taxiing in outer space, that is, space transportation, and even the idea of space resource extraction and exploitation, and temporary, even permanent settlement of celestial bodies. If one shares the opinion that in principle private space activities, if undertaken according to the rules of astrophysics, orbital mechanics, healthcare, and the law of outer space are a positive development, since it would free, at least partly, governmental budgets from enormous loads, then the question has to be asked whether international space law in general and the triangle of no sovereignty, quasi-territorial jurisdiction over space objects and any personnel thereof, and denial of property acquisition on celestial bodies will further this development. With regard to settling of celestial bodies, which has so far not yet been attempted, one would, besides the question of physical conditions of survival on a celestial body as being out of the scope of these considerations, and will therefore not be discussed here, any habitation of the moon, as an example, through travelers and temporary visitors will not change anything with regard to the three mentioned concepts. Be it that astronauts bring building a material from the Earth, be it that they build their habitat with lunar regolith, all this would not necessitate or cause a change to the existing space law concepts or the wider concepts of, for example, property. In the former case, all stays as it was on Earth, and even in the latter case, the lunar regolith will not change its legal nature. Nonetheless, space resource activities certainly pose the most difficult and most immediate case from the viewpoint of current space law. The question of space resource extraction, as already noted above, is viewed as lawful only by a minority opinion, whereas according to the majority, and I share this view, such kind of exploitation of celestial bodies would be against valid international law and must be rejected. One important point must, however, be noted as required yesterday. It is expected that the era of outer space, of new space, sorry, may more private and governmental users will become active in outer space, and the number of space objects will continue to grow at unprecedented rates. These will enter into an area, the solar system, that after almost 70 years of space flight is full of space debris. What is therefore urgently needed is what we call a space debris management. We call it also space traffic management, similarly to air traffic management, but of course with other important questions that I cannot go into detail, as I was indicated here. The question must be moreover posed of whether especially these new space activities could be misused to circumvent the prohibition of appropriation from Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty. For example, it is questionable whether large constellations of satellites can be misused to de facto appropriate certain orbital regions by relying on the concepts of the freedom of use of Article 1 of the Outer Space Treaty and jurisdiction in space objects from Article 8 of the Outer Space Treaty. To illustrate, when considering the most recent development of, for example, launching large constellations of up to 40,000 satellites, mini-satellites, it may be asked whether this, in view of jurisdiction and control of the state of registry vis-à-vis the satellite of the large constellations, is not a de facto denial of the prohibition to claim sovereignty over parts of outer space, as enshrined in Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty. And here I cut short again and come to my conclusion. Considering the aforementioned, what can be concluded of the triangle? It can certainly be confirmed that the three concepts regulated similar subject matters from different aspects concerning the freedom of subjects of act with regard to an object. Hereby, outer space legislation clearly prohibits the exercise of state sovereignty with regard to outer space and celestial bodies, while simultaneously permitting an aspect of it to remain over registered space objects via the concept of state jurisdiction. This is the first side of the triangle connecting sovereignty and jurisdiction. Property, moreover, is indirectly referenced twice, forming the other two sides of the triangle. On the one end, it is prohibited, or at the very least restricted, depending on which interpretation one follows, by Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty, through the prohibition of national appropriation, which certainly prohibits the state sovereignty. As noted above, if states are prohibited from exercising sovereign rights over an object, for example, they do not have rights to a thing, they cannot grant these rights through national legislation, for example, property rights via national space laws. On the other hand, and forming the final side of the triangle, property rights are indirectly referenced to the invocation of ownership in Article 8 of the Outer Space Treaty, whereby they are tied into the preceding concept of jurisdiction and control. Hereby, property rights refer to objects launched into outer space from Earth, stating that rights over these shall not be affected by its mere presence in outer space, meaning that exercise of jurisdiction is not affected. For example, owners of objects can assert national legislation of the registering state for its grievances affected their property rights in an object launched. Hence, the triangle remains a vital part of space activities and ongoing discussions, and may even see change as space activities evolve. In particular, as a lack of clear hierarchy in the Outer Space Treaty, coupled with different views on how these self-same norms are to be interpreted, could lead to competing views as to which provisions should be given priority and how. This holds especially true for future activities such as the not-so-unthinkable settlement of celestial bodies, the Earth, moons, or Mars. This would again require a new generation of space law, the law of space settlement, in which fundamental principles of human existence may be rethought. In conclusion, therefore, space law at the age of 70 years is in urgent need of revision and further development. Otherwise, a real danger exists that even fundamental principles, like the prohibition of appropriation from Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty, will factually be overridden by new developments such as the large constellations of satellites. Thereby, it must be emphasized that the future evolution needs to recenter it from a law solely serving governmental actors to a law that reaches out to new commercial entities and can respond quicker and with more efficiency to a considerably greater number of actors and space objects. It needs, for example, besides urgent conceptual rethinking, maybe through interpretative guidelines, also to ensure more effective activity management and environmental protection. Thank you very much indeed for your attention.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.